It's time for the one show that takes you where others won't. Out into the wilderness, past the frontiers of what you thought possible, with your own personal guide through this strange new landscape, the pilgrim on the 405, Mr. Will Crist.
Well, welcome to Pilgrim Talks on this rainy day here in Southern California. Sometimes there are interesting things that happen, and one wonders whether one is in charge or maybe something else is in charge that allows us to move forward. A month ago, I got a call, an email from a friend of mine, Michael Luckman, who said, look, I've just published my new book, and I'd love to be on the radio show with you. And I said, fine, we'll put you on the radio show sometime. Well, it happens. Sometimes schedules get scuttled, and people who want to be on the radio show can't be for any one of a number of reasons. They get sick, they get called out of town. Well, yesterday that happened. So I called up Michael and said, Michael, can you be with us tomorrow on the radio show? He said, fine, but I can do it at 5:30. So I rustled around to find somebody new and see if there's somebody who could come in at 5 o'clock, but I couldn't find anybody. So I have Michael's book, and I'm going to try something new today. If it doesn't work, we'll just erase it and forget about it. But I'm going to read a couple of chapters of Michael's book, and then he'll join us after the break at 5:30 and talk about what this means to him and what this can be for other people. Now, this book is called Overcoming Fear. And his point is that lots of people feel fear. In fact, if you Google fear, you find all sorts of responses to that. Lots of people. You take a look at how many people every day Google fear, and it's millions of people looking for ways to deal with anxiety and fear. And, well, Michael's taken this on. So we're going to spend the next 25 minutes reading a couple of chapters of Michael's book. We'll see how far we get. And then our producer's going to call Michael at 5:25 and get him on the show after the ad, after we take a break for an ad from Sandler Training. And then we'll let Michael talk about what we've seen. So here we go. This is Michael, chapter one, A Little About Me. Michael says, my name is Michael Luckman, and I'm proud to be a peddler. I even come from a long line of proud peddlers. What is a peddler? Well, the dictionary defines to peddle as a transitive verb meaning to sell goods, especially while traveling from place to place. And nowhere was it more prevalent than in the Old West as pioneers crossed the Midwestern plains and the Western mountains to settle the new territories. Now, often these farmers and ranchers settled in areas even before there was a town nearby. Without a retail store to provide these rugged pioneers with needed essentials, entrepreneurs would go from homestead to homestead, first by walking, then with wagon loads of products, selling pots and pans, tobacco, fabrics to make new clothes, and hundreds of other everyday products, sort of like a mini Walmart that came to you. Now, these rugged entrepreneurs eventually settled down and opened what was referred to as dry goods stores. These mom-and-pop shops later became our department stores of today. So Michael says, I am a salesman, and I'm very proud of it. I've sold all my life, and as a kid, I was a Cub Scout and then a Boy Scout, and every Scout had to have a subscription to Boys Life magazine. And on the back of every issue was an advertisement for a company that sold consumable goods, and its way of going to market was to hire boys 8 to 12 years old to sell for them. In the spring, I sold flour and vegetable seed packets for my neighbor's gardens. In the fall, it was boxed greeting cards for the holidays. I wasn't paid in cash. Instead, I earned points. You see, you saved up your points and then turned them in for a bicycle, a baseball glove, a football, camping equipment, or a myriad of other products every kid wanted. It was my first taste of entrepreneurship and fear. I had to climb the steps of each of my neighbors' houses and with a trembling hand ring the doorbell while practicing in my mind what I was going to say and pray I didn't stumble over the words. It was my first lesson in learning that selling and fear go hand in hand. But even though it was scary, what propelled me to push myself through the fear was what I dreamed of at night, earning enough points for a bicycle. Not just any bike, but a Schwinn, the Cadillac of bicycles. I got to be honest with you, I never earned that bicycle. And it wasn't until years later in a college marketing course that I learned why I never got the bike. It had nothing to do with working hard. I worked hard. I forced myself to ring those doorbells. No, it had to do with something marketers refer to as gratification, instant and delayed. At the end of each year, when looking at the total points I'd earned, I was faced with this dilemma. Should I save my points and bank them for some unknown time in the future when I would have enough points for the bike? Delayed gratification. Or should I use them to purchase something I wanted now, like a football or a baseball glove? Instant gratification. Well, since I already told you I never got the bike, it's obvious that I succumbed to the intoxicating pull of instant gratification. Well, I earned it. I wanted it. And I wanted it now. Isn't that the American way? When I was 15 years old, I got a job at Mr. Junior, a boys' clothing store on Chicago's north side near Devon and California streets. And no more being paid with points. I was in the workforce. I was not only a full-fledged salesman, but I was being paid 75 cents an hour to do it. I not only loved what I was doing, but I was good at it. I was in high school and working two evenings a week. Those stores were only open Monday and Thursday nights then. And I worked on Saturday. Now, once I got over my fear of approaching customers, I find that I had a genuine gift for sales, and I was having fun. I was a Mr. Junior silver-tongued devil, and it wasn't long before I was their number one part-time salesperson. But since this is a book on overpowering fear, you probably want to know how this 15-year-old kid learned to get past his fears. At that age, you're somewhere between childhood and adulthood, old enough to be working, but still young enough where interactions with adults scared me. Ringing my neighbor's doorbells and selling them seed packets was a piece of cake compared to walking up to a complete stranger and introducing myself and then engaging them in a conversation. Working on the floor with three other salespeople, we would rotate turns and approaching potential customers as they walked through the door. And since this was a children's clothing store, the majority of our walk-ins were parents accompanied by their children looking for new clothes. When it was my turn to walk up to a customer, I could feel the fear beginning to rise to my body, starting in my lower gut and moving up through my chest until I could hear my rapidly beating heart thundering in my ears. Took everything I had to take my first faltering steps toward the new customer and keep my voice from cracking as I said hello and asked them if I could help. Now, since I was the new kid, I was still learning the inventory and the different boy sizes and not remembering what size I'd worn at any age growing up. I found that once the conversation started, the fear I was feeling would usually dissipate to a point where I began to feel more and more comfortable in the buyer-selling relationship. But I think it was an assistant store manager who, seeing my discomfort, took me aside one Saturday morning and asked me how I was doing. I was more than a bit embarrassed when I told him I was scared approaching customers. His response after a short laugh was to tell me it was perfectly natural to feel some fear. That it was almost the same as an actor walking out on stage at the beginning of a play and all the butterflies they experience. He then told me something that made perfect sense. He said, these people are coming into our store because they want to buy new clothes for their child. They're here and looking for help. Your role as a salesperson is to find out why they came into the store and then provide them the help they need in picking out the right items in the right size. And he finished our little pep talk with this touchstone. He said, just before you approach a new customer, say to yourself, showtime, feel the butterflies, and add, it's okay to feel some fear, Michael. Just go ahead and do it. He was right. The fear would last maybe a minute or two, and then it became fun. Yeah, fun. I wouldn't want to go back to working retail now because the thought of standing on my feet for 8 hours would be pure hell. But I missed the opportunity to meet new people and see how fast I could develop some rapport with them. And then, of course, how much I could sell them. I worked there about 6 months when a new men's clothing store opened up not far from my house at the Howard and Western Shopping Center. It was a men's clothing store owned by an Austrian Holocaust survivor by the name of Max Kastner. Now, Max was a tough man to work for, but a very successful entrepreneur who had just opened his fifth Kastner's California men's shop. It was also my first introduction to marketing. You see, nothing in the store was even remotely tied to California. But these were the days of the Beach Boys and the Mamas and the Papas, California dreaming, and everybody wanted to live in California. So having the word California in your store's name was pure marketing genius. Within 6 months sales experience, with 6 months sales experience under my belt, I applied to Max for a job in his new store. When he asked what I was being paid, I bumped up my hourly wage by a third and told him I was making $1 an hour. Keep in mind, prospects lie and salespeople embellish. Well, I embellished my income. He agreed to give me a chance and offer me the job at $1 an hour. I was thrilled! Not only was the store within walking distance from home, but it was a step up from what I was selling. It wasn't kids' clothes anymore. This was the big time. I was selling men's clothing to men and women who valued my services and liked the fact that I had a flair for putting together just the right look. And what I mean by that was I could sell the husband a suit and then take them over to the dress shirts and find just the right shirt to go with the suit, then the perfect tie and a new pair of dress shoes. I suggested and they bought. I could upsell, cross-sell, before I even know what those phrases meant. It's funny. I don't know where this talent came from. The joke in our family, even to this day, was that as a family, we were devoid of talent. Nobody could sing, nobody could dance. Most of us, when it came to any art, we could only draw a stick figure, certainly me. No one had a gift for writing, and no one had any musical talent. So where did this talent for putting together outfits and matching and blending colors come from? Well, maybe it was in my blood since I came from a long line of merchants. And maybe it was just a God-given talent, although I wouldn't know what it was called. Either way, I loved what I was doing, and it probably helped that I really liked people and truly enjoyed helping them. My best sale came one Sunday the week after Father's Day. It just so happened that my dad dropped in to visit me while I was working at Kastner Stores in downtown Skokie, Illinois. A gentleman came in to return a sweater he'd gotten as a gift. I returned the sweater for him, and since we were hitting it off, and I was beginning to understand his tastes, I started showing him other items. Some things I thought he might like. And when it was all said and done, the total of his new purchases came to just over $1,000. Today, $1,000 may buy you one suit, but in the early 1960s, when a Petrocelli suit set you back $250 and a mohair cardigan sweater could be had for about $20 and an Enro white-on-white shirt was $12.99, you got a whole lot of clothes for $1,000. I'll never forget the pride I saw in my dad's eyes as he watched me sell. Those moments, they stay with you forever. I was asked afterwards how this came about. How was I able to go from returning an item to making a $1,000 sale? I would typically reply, I guess he just liked me. But looking back on it now, there was definitely more to the story. Getting people to like you is not an easy task. One, you have to genuinely like people. I do. I love talking to people and finding out about them. Their lives, their work, their dreams, all those things. Two, you can't just ask them questions about themselves without opening up about yourself. And the more things you share about yourself, the more comfortable they'll feel about opening up to you. And three, put a smile on your face and in your voice. Be friendly. Be approachable. Be the first to stick out your hand and say hello. I know it's scary sometimes. But if you want to get people to like you, and you're going to need to do these things. And now the more you do them, the easier it gets. In grade school, I was not quite in the popular group. That group was made up of the kids who were the best athletes, the jocks. And I wasn't in the nerdy group. I fell somewhere in between. Starting high school was a fearful event for most of us, and it certainly was for me. But within several months of acclaiming myself to this new environment, I discovered something about myself that I hadn't known before. I had this ability to make people laugh. I had what was referred to as a quick wit. Quick-witted is defined as mentally alert and sharp, keen. What it really meant for me was that I could think on my feet. I could quickly come back with a retort when someone said something or asked me something, and this usually meant a smart-ass answer. Of course, there's a time and a place for smart-ass answers, and school was not one of them. But being funny boosted my popularity. At Sullivan High School in Chicago, there was a chair with my name on it, right outside Mr. Fenn's office, the assistant principal. He would see to it that I would have a four-day school week because one day a week, sometimes I was suspended. I found while working at Kastner's that this ability can work in your favor when used to establish bonding and rapport with customers. I wish I could give you a short course in quick-wittedness, but I don't think it's something that can be taught. Although you may have this innate ability already, but fear prevents you from using it. Fear that you'll embarrass yourself and perhaps say the wrong thing. And believe me, that can happen. If you're quick-witted around your family and friends, but not prospects, then you need to get over your fear and let the real you come out. Prospects will probably like that about you, and that's how you create a bond. That's how you build rapport, and that's how you close a sale. I work for Kastner's California Men's Shops part-time during the school year and full-time during summers, for the rest of high school and during most of college. I was a good employee who not only sold well, but at 16 years old, was mature enough to take over management of the different stores while the managers went on their summer vacations. I loved selling. I loved the thrill of making the sale, but I also enjoyed the challenge of bonding and building rapport with a customer. After 43 years in sales, with the last 10 training salespeople, I believe that building rapport and developing a bond with the prospect is the most important thing you can do in a sales call. Bonding rapport creates trust. All things being equal, people want to do business with people they trust. The more they trust, the easier the sale. Now, you're probably asking, well, that all sounds pretty good, but what does that have to do with fear? It doesn't sound like you experience much fear working retail. First, let me state unequivocally, I am a fear-based person. I was born into fear, and it has been a constant companion throughout most of my life. When I say I was born into fear, let me describe to you my birth. I was the second child of Adeline and Melvin Luckman. My older sister, Ramona, was 1 month shy of her fourth birthday, and the Japanese had just surrendered the week before, ending World War II. Mom was 25 years old, and the times were looking up. Now, I've got the details of my birth down pretty good, and I'll tell you why. As September 9th rolls around, Mom, in painstakingly detail, describes the saga of my birth to me. It was a stifling hot Sunday morning in early September when Mom's water broke. I want to say Dad whisked her away to the hospital in his car, but I don't think he owned a car at the time. I think he took my grandfather's car. Either way, Dad took Mom to Illinois Masonic Hospital, where, after admittance, she was placed on a gurney and wheeled into the delivery room area. Now, this was the beginning of the baby boom, and delivery rooms were often crowded. Since Mom had not dilated all that much, the nurses felt she could wait in the hallway where another new mom got the delivery room. As it was, I decided not to wait. With no one around and Mom all alone on that gurney, I came into this world at 7:30 a.m. Central Daylight Savings Time. That all sounds pretty sterile and straightforward. But for a moment, let's think of Mom. What was she feeling that early September morning? Mom was scared to death, screaming and with no drugs to ease the pain, and no one around to come to her aid. Mom was never like those Native American women who gave birth by just leaning up against a tree and dropping the little papoose onto the ground, nor was she a Rosie the Riveter during the war. Mom was a housewife. So as you can imagine, the very first rush I ever felt was from Mom's adrenaline coursing through my tiny little body. It was fear, pure, unadulterated fear. But I felt it then and every day since. So let's take a look at what I was afraid of. My earliest fear recollection was of being with my mom shopping on Lawrence Avenue. As with most preschoolers, I was much more interested in looking in the store windows and watching the people go by than following my mother as she was walking away. It wasn't long before I realized that she wasn't there anymore, and fear and panic gripped my little body. I began crying and running down Lawrence Avenue, calling for my mother, with the belief forming in my mind that I would never see her again. Of course, she wasn't too far away and heard my screams and quickly came to my aid. The stern lecture I got about paying attention was outweighed by my relief at being found. But the fear of abandonment stayed with me. Every time my parents would leave the house after that and a babysitter would come to stay with my sister and me, I would fear that my parents would never come home. I know that most kids have some apprehension about their first day of school. The little 5-year-old boy walking with his mom in front of my mom and me on my first day of kindergarten vomited on the steps of our new school. At least I kept my lunch down. Actually, kindergarten wasn't so scary. It was the first day of the first grade that fear of school took hold. The teacher passed out a large sheet of construction paper, and with a crayon, we were asked to write our numbers from 1 to 100. As my classmates and I began our assignment, fear gripped me and panic began to set in. I was okay from 1 to 10, but that was it. I was lost from that point on. No one had taught me how to count past 10. Wasn't that what school was for? Up until that point in my life, I never gave intelligence a thought. In fact, I thought I was pretty smart. Isn't that what mommies and daddies tell us? But not anymore. My new belief, and one that would last most of my life, that was, I wasn't very smart. My new belief was that others, just about everyone, were smarter than me. Others learn new things quickly. I, on the other hand, struggled. Now, what happens to children who have this belief about themselves? It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you believe that you're not smart and that it's hard to learn new things, then learning new things becomes a struggle and school is not a pleasant experience. I should probably share with you my parents' conversation with me after every parent-teacher conference they ever attended. Mike, Mrs. Every Teacher, thinks that you're not working up to your potential, that you're capable of much better work. Well, you could certainly have fooled me. I thought I was working up to my potential. It was just my potential was not quite as high as most of the other kids in my class. I didn't tell them that. That was my secret. But I always ended these conversations with a promise that I would work harder. But how do you work harder at something that fear tells you you can't do? Now, that's what fear does to us. It reminds us of our shortcomings. It tells us we're not good enough, not smart enough, not talented enough, not bright enough, not athletic enough, not creative enough, not handsome, not beautiful, not coordinated, and certainly not deserving enough. We are just plain not enough. But others, yes, others, they are. They're everything we're not. We desire to be like them. They're the people who don't suffer like we do. By some magical gift of birth, they've got it all together. They don't feel fear. They face every day's challenges head on and succeed at everything that we fail at. They don't struggle. We do. They're everything we are not. They are what we want to be. So who are they? These mythical, perfect people who live amongst us. Well, actually, they are us. You see, when we came into this world, we were each given a little gift. Now, I know there are some of you who will argue this gift came later when we as toddlers separated ourselves from our primary caretakers. But I like to think it came with our name, because our individual unique name defined us to the world. It was our I. I am Michael Luckman. You are you. And along with our name came this protector of our I from other people's I. We call this protector our ego. Now let's begin by understanding your ego is not your friend. Friends say and do things that make us feel good about ourselves. Egos say and do things that make us feel bad, sometimes real bad. Your ego is of the body, and when you die, your ego dies with you. It's not something you can bequeath to others, nor would others want it. They've got their own egos to deal with. Our egos are there to constantly compare us to others. They are the egos that remind us of all that we are that are not enough. Now, where does the ego get this garbage from? Well, egos get it from others. Others who have judged us, either rightly or wrongly. There are parents, grandparents, siblings, friends, schoolmates, teammates, teachers, boyfriends, girlfriends, spouses, employers, and the list goes on and on. Sometimes these things have been told us with love. Well, don't worry about this, honey. Some kids are just better at math than others. You'll be good at something else. And sometimes they've been told with malice. We don't want Luckman on our team. He couldn't catch the ball if we put it in his hands. Either way, your ego remembers these things and in an instant will remind you of them, and to hell with how you feel. As I said, your ego is not your friend. When faced with new challenges, the first thing our ego does is to whisper to us, you can't do that. You are not fill in the blank enough. You'll be found out that you're not too fill in the blank. And everybody will laugh at you. You won't be able to take the embarrassment and the humiliation. You'll lose your job. You'll lose your friends. Your life as you know it will be over. And with these words from our ego, these words of endearment, comes the fear. The fear that grips our hearts. The fear that becomes the knot in our bellies. The fear that sets our minds racing with one delusional thought after another. The fear that forces us to give up the things in our lives that we truly want and that we truly deserve. It is this fear that makes us compromise our dreams. The fear that makes us settle for less. This senseless, irrational fear that keeps us plodding along the ground with turkeys instead of soaring with eagles where we truly belong. We were each destined for greatness if only we could overpower our fears. Chapter 1 of Michael Luckman's book, Overpowering Fear. We're going to take a break, hear from our friends at Sandler Training, and then we'll get Michael to talk a little bit about this chapter and about his book in general. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Bob Barber with Sandler Training. I'm here to talk to you about rule number 6. Don't buy back tomorrow what you sold today. I was talking to a salesperson the other day and he'd closed a big deal. Gone to the bank, cashed the check, the works. Unfortunately, he got a 4 o'clock in the morning phone call from a prospect saying, put a hold on things, something's come up. He'd had second thoughts. Second thoughts. Have you ever had second thoughts? Of course you have. It's human nature. It's usually right after you let your daughter stay out late on Friday night, or you order dessert or buy that new car. Did I make the right decision? It's only human nature. Traditional salespeople tend to rush through that process, hope that the person doesn't have their human nature natural reaction of second thoughts or buyer's remorse. They try to close the deal, pass that problem on to somebody else, get that contract processed. At Sandler, we help the prospect embrace that. Bring it up, help them go through it, work through that second thought, that buyer's remorse. It might sound something like, Jim, I'm looking forward to working with you. I think it's going to be fun. This accounting solution is what your company needs. Now, you were a little concerned that we couldn't get the conversion in place within 3 weeks. It's going to be more like 5. Are you going to be okay with that? Help that person work through it. What better way to reinforce the role of a trusted advisor than to help that person work through their buyer's remorse? Rule number 6, don't buy back tomorrow what you sold today.
Well, we have finished reading the first chapter of Michael's book now. Let's welcome Michael to the show and have a little chance to talk about it. Michael, are you there?
I am here.
Well, welcome. Did you hear what we did?
I understand that you read the first chapter of the book?
Yeah, we did. We read the chapter on fear and ego and you growing up, and just about 30 minutes long, so we had a good time.
Wonderful, wonderful. So now you know more about me than you ever did, huh?
That's right. That's right. So tell me about, what was going on as you were writing this book? What was that like?
Interesting. A question. Writing the book was actually it was a labor of love. It was wonderful in parts, and most of it was wonderful. But there was as you get into the book, as you know, that there is some, you know, I talk about the things in my life and the challenges that I faced, and you know, I look at myself more like the common man. And so, going back on as I'm writing these things, there was a lot of pain that came up, a lot of hurt, a lot of remembrance, but a lot of joy there too. And it's interesting, as you look back on your life, you see what you did and where you made your mistakes, and when you bumped up against fear, how you worked, overpowered it. So, but overall, well, it was really a labor of love. It was really enjoyable doing it.
So what was the discipline that you used to write it? I mean, I've heard some people go into their studies or their retreats and they just start writing, and they'll write for weeks and weeks and finish the whole thing all at once. Others write one paragraph a day. How did you write it?
I wrote, interestingly, the book is not, as you can see, it's not in a chronological order. I jump around. And I was very, very fortunate to work with a fantastic editor and publisher, Nance Rosen. And Nance and I would be on the phone at least once a week, probably usually 2 hours or more. And we would be talking just in general terms, just talking about what was going on, and then things would come up in my past, and we'd start talking about that, and all of a sudden we had the idea for a chapter. So I would write a chapter and then edit it and send it off to Nance, and then we'd talk, and I'd write another chapter. And interestingly, when it went to put the book together, because it wasn't like a novel where you pick off where you left off, you pick up where you left off in the last chapter, and then you start writing the next. It was, I basically printed out every chapter, and I laid it on my bed, and I put the book together that way, because, you know, I wanted it to make sense, and I think I did. I hope I did anyway, or at least in the first chapter that you read.
Did you write all day? 4 days at a time? Did you write an hour a day? What kind of discipline did you have to have?
That's discipline is a tough thing, because I mean, there were times that I sat down at my computer and nothing would come, and those were difficult times. But I didn't have a set routine, because, of course, I was working too, so I had to work around it. I had to do it in the times that I wasn't, you know, running my business or training salespeople. So it was a process. Almost, there were times that everything seemed to flow, and there were times that you looked at your computer screen and you said, geez, what the hell should I write now, you know? So I love telling stories, and if I could get into a story there, then it usually flowed.
Uh-huh. Good. Well, let's talk a little bit about this notion of fear. You know, what is the most profound lesson that you've learned about overpowering fear and enjoying success?
Back at a training that I was at a few years back, somebody said... that it was a very profound statement. It said that everything that you have ever wanted has always been on the other side of fear. And it sort of just struck me, because I am a fear-based person. I was born into fear. I've had fear throughout my life. There was not a day that went by that I did not feel fear. And it wasn't like fear of snakes or fear of spiders or fear of flying. It was fear of meeting new people, new events, things that would happen, you know, fear of recess or fear of going out and playing baseball and being laughed at if I did drop the ball. So I always believed that I had these fears. And when this gentleman mentioned this, that said everything that you have ever wanted has always been on the other side of fear, it struck me that I wasn't alone. That fear is sort of ubiquitous. Everybody feels it. And then the more that I started thinking about this concept, the more I realized that I mean, we have fear since we were little kids, since we were small, and some of us carry those same fears with us. You know, I mean, one of the things that every toddler, when they go outside, their mommy and daddies would always say to them, never talk to strangers. And now they own their own business, but they're the chief salesperson for their business, and they've got to talk to strangers. But they're afraid. And it's crazy. So I think learning that fear, that everybody feels fear, and everybody lets fear, and everybody negotiates with fear, and all too often, people let fear stop them in their tracks.
Well, so in writing this book, what is it that you've discovered about fear that might help the rest of us?
Well, fear is not real. Fear is created by the delusional thoughts in our minds. Let me. I'm just go back just a little bit. Fear. You and I wouldn't be talking on this call today if our ancestors didn't have fear. Fear works through the senses, the five senses. And when we were living in caves, you know, if we heard the rustling in the grasses or twigs breaking, that might have been a warning that there might have been a saber-toothed tiger out there or something that can eat us. And so what would happen is the senses would go to the oldest part of our brain. They call it the reptilian brain. And there's a little core there that's called the amygdala. And I'm simplifying this because I am not a doctor. But when those senses, when we pick up on those senses, smell, taste, or our sight, and the amygdala is warned, what happens to us is our body goes into a fight or flight response. And by that I mean what happens is physiologically, our heartbeat starts up faster. The blood goes from our stomach. Our blood is being pumped through. Our breathing is increased. We're bringing in more oxygen to mix with the sugars in our blood to create energy. The blood is going away from the digestive tract to our muscles so that we can either fight whatever fearful out there or we can run. And this kept us alive. But the interesting thing is, Will, is that when you, let's say you're a salesperson, okay, and you have to make those cold calls, you have to pick up the phone. What happens is our mind is creating all these delusional thoughts. Oh, I'm interrupting the prospect. Oh, they don't really want to talk to me. I hate when I get cold calls, so I hate making them. They're going to probably reject me, and I'm going to feel bad. And what happens to our body is the exact same thing that would happen to us if today we would step out of our house and a mountain lion had come down from the hills around us and was on our driveway. We would have that fight or flight syndrome. Most likely would be flight. I mean, we're not going to fight that lion. But why? Isn't it ridiculous? Isn't it crazy that we have to pick up the phone to call another human being and our mind is coming up with all these delusional thoughts and our body is responding in this way? It's crazy.
Well, So when did you finally see fear as something you could overpower, you could get beyond? Was it all of a sudden in one moment, or was it over a process, over months or years? Yeah. What was that event for you? How did you begin to see differently?
Okay, well, I wish I could say that I snapped my fingers one day and all that fear disappeared. If you notice, the title of my book is Overpowering Fear, as opposed to Overcoming Fear. And I don't say or profess to say that you can all of a sudden one day your fears are going to be gone. I'm not saying even for myself that my fears aren't gone. It's the way it's learning to manage those fears rather than negotiating with those fears and letting fear win. See, Will, when fear wins, we've lost. Whatever it was that we changed our mind on, if we didn't make that call to that CEO of that company because our mind convinced us, our thoughts convinced us that they really didn't want to talk to us, we lost something there. And so when I started looking at things, and this probably, you know, starting maybe about 20 years ago, where I'm looking at this fear and I'm saying, this is irrational. I'm fearing these things. So I started, you know, when faced with fear, instead of negotiating it with it and succumbing to fear, I would say, I can do it. And I, of course, I learned a lot of methods that I put into the book on that people can use to overpower those fears, but they're never really going to overcome the fear, and that's okay. You don't have to overcome the fear. You just have to find ways to face the fear and make it manageable and go ahead and do the things that are necessary, the things that you fear.
So
does it become easier? Yes, that it does. Over the years, it does become easier. Do I feel that fear when I have to pick up the phone and make a cold call? Yes. Are my hands clammy? Is my voice cracking? No. But I'm still feeling that fear. And my thoughts would say, Michael, wouldn't you rather be outside doing something than making these cold calls? And I would say, yes, I'm sure I would. But I'm going to make the cold calls because I know that I can overpower the fear. And I know that by making those cold calls, I'll win. I'll get a meeting. And I get enough meetings, I'm going to make enough presentations and proposals that are going to turn into enough sales. And then I've won. I've beaten it.
What are some how-to tips that people can use to, discover what fears they have that are getting in the way of what they could be? And what are some actions they can do to defeat the fears after they recognize them?
Good. Well, one of the things that I found, and in fact, it's the second exercise in the book. There are 10 exercises in the book that people can do. The first one is identifying your fears. And I usually suggest on that people take that legal pad or whatever, that they go into a quiet room, they relax, and they just ask, you know, they ask the question, what are my fears? Essentially, what they're doing is they're asking the universe, what are my fears? Because oftentimes, we really can't identify them because the average person thinks 60,000 thoughts a day. Your mind is working 24 hours a day, and the average mind, the average person, will think 60,000 thoughts a day. And we know that better than 90% of them are negative. So that's 54,000 negative thoughts that we're fighting with a day. So the first thing, we have to identify our fears. But the second exercise in the book is so vitally important because we take three fears from the list that we put together and we look at those fears. Where did it come from? How long have we experienced these fears? How have these fears affected us in our life with our family, with our boss, at work, at home, at play? And then I remember learning that when we're talking to a prospect about the problems they're facing or the pain they're facing, we want to quantify that by how much it's costing them. Because when you get the prospect to talk about what the problems that they're facing in their sales team, let's say, that there is a certain cost to it. Are they missing a segment of the market? What is that market worth? What's their average account worth? How many new accounts can their people develop? So once we understand in selling what the problems or the pain that the prospect is facing and what it's costing them, we do the same thing in this exercise by what does that fear cost you? Now, since you train salespeople, and that's been my background, and I am a salesperson, that it's easier, you know, we can understand that every time you face a fear and you succumb to it, meaning you didn't overpower it, you talked yourself out of doing whatever you needed to do, what has that cost you? Let's say you're in a chamber group and they give you, or a leads group, and you get a lead. And somebody says, you got to talk to this guy. And it happens to be the CEO of a major company. And you've got an entree, you've got somebody who gave you a lead or a referral, but you start justifying in your mind why they wouldn't want to talk to you. And so you never call them. And you say to yourself, well, since I never sold to them, I never got the commission, I never got the income, I didn't lose anything. Yes, you did. You lost that commission. You gave it to your competitor. Not only did you give it to your competitor, but let's take it one step further, and this is what we do in the exercise. What would that money have purchased, have bought you? Would it bought you a nicer car? Would it bought you a larger home or your first home? Would it bought you the honeymoon that you never were able to take with your wife? And when people start listing what this fear has cost them, it's an eye-opening exercise, because people then say, oh my God, I never realized how much better my life would be if I had that additional income. And the only reason I don't have that income is because I gave in to my fears.
All right. So how do we get over those fears? What can we do to get beyond them?
Well, once we understand them, once we know what they're costing us, we're going to be in a much stronger position when faced with those fears to go ahead and do it. I mean, it's going to be, no matter what, that's why you're not overcoming your fear, you're overpowering it, because the fear will still be with you. What can you do? I mean, understand that the fear is not real. Understand where it's coming from. Understand that the response is ridiculous. It's crazy. It's only caused by the delusional thoughts. Now, I'm going to go back. I mentioned that we have these 60,000 thoughts in a day, and 90% of them, better than 90% of them, are negative. The thing we must do is we must change the thought that's in our mind from a negative. See, this is how you know let me explain this. How you feel, Will, those fearful feelings in the pit of your stomach, your heartbeat, the emptiness in your chest, the rapid breathing, you're feeling negative. You're feeling not very good. Your hands are sweating. You're afraid to pick up the phone. What the first thing we have to do is we have to go and take a look in our mind and say, what am I thinking? What's going on in my mind that is causing this? And we might be thinking, oh, we might be one of those people that might be intimidated by title, that we're comfortable calling it a buyer level, or as Tony Perinello talks, linoleumville. And what mm-hmm. we're really talking about is calling at the top, calling the CEO, but we're intimidated by that title. And then we have to say to ourselves, we have to get rid of that thought that that person doesn't want to talk to us, or what if I choke on my words? And we have to look at it. We say, we have to change that to a positive thought. And a positive thought might be, this person that I'm going to call is probably facing this pain, and I believe that I can help them with my product or my service to overpower that pain, to get it out of their life. And so this person doesn't know me yet and doesn't know how I can help them, but I can make their life better by them buying my product. And so we must change that negative thought that's causing those negative feelings to a positive thought, which will give you a much more positive feeling. And actually, that positive feeling will flow through on that call, be it on the phone or in person. So that's one of the ways. There are quite a few other ways in there that we can go into. I mean, there's another one that I believe is great. It was developed by Dale Carnegie in the 1930s. And that was, you ask yourself, what's the worst that can happen? And then you write it down, and then you say, you end it with and then you write down whatever comes to you next, and by the time you're finished with it, you've taken that great big fearful thought, and you reduced it down to nothingness. So there's a couple ways that you could do it, and there's a whole bunch of other ways too.
Yeah, well, now you talked a little bit about a relationship with spirit. We didn't, not in the first chapter that we just read, but later on in the book, you talk about this relationship. It's very personal. It's an ongoing relationship with spirit, which is a force in the, I guess it's the force in the universe, that supports you. How do you connect with the spirit, and how does that affect your life?
Okay. It affects it greatly, Will. I got into spirituality about the same time that I was searching for ways to overpower my fear. And ever since I was a little kid, I never believed in organized religion. I just always believed that there was a God, and he wasn't a God from the Old Testament that was a fearful God. You got to fear God. I always believed in a loving God, because I never believed that God could give you free will and then draw a line in the sand and say, you've got free will, but if you step over this line, I'm going to strike you dead. And so I never really accepted that. And it was probably in the mid-80s where I started. I got into a men's group, and one of our facilitators was a psychiatrist who happened to be very spiritual, and he introduced me to spirituality, and I began to see my connection with God, and or the universe, or the universal mind. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that you can approach it. You could use God or spirit or universal mind or Jesus or Buddha or Muhammad. It doesn't matter. It's you and your personal relationship with this higher power. And there's also a book that I continue reading. I've had it for about 15 years now, maybe even longer. It's called A Course in Miracles. And there's some great... There's just some great, great parts of that that have just stuck with me and just become a part of my life. Like, in fact, there's a chapter in the book called Littleness Versus Magnitude. This comes directly out of A Course in Miracles. And then it talks about, and I change magnitude to greatness, because my belief is that each of us was born to greatness. Each of us was born to have, to be, and to do everything that we can, that's our destiny. Our destiny is greatness. But it is fear that stops us, because in down the way there, we can see the future, or the future's there, and it's waiting for us. But if we don't move through the fears that are holding us in place, we'll never reach our greatness. We'll never reach that abundance, the prosperity, the life of our dreams that is guaranteed to us by God. There's another quote that I use in the book that I have taken out of A Course in Miracle, and it says, it's not that we ask God for too much, it's that we ask God for too little. And oftentimes that goes back to some basic beliefs we may have, that we're not deserving of having everything, that other people deserve it. But and that comes in my family. It came, I mean, when I was growing up, we never got the best. We always settled. We always compromised for something less than the best. And what I'm saying is that God wants us to have the best. He wants us to have everything. And then that came to looking at what is stopping me from having everything, and it came down, it's my fears.
And so you have turned to spirit to help you overcome to overpower fears. Is that right?
Exactly. It's my strong belief in God, and I speak to spirit. You know, I'll ask spirit for what I wanted. You know, a few minutes before your producer called, I said, Spirit, I'm going to be talking to this great guy that I've known for 10 years now, and I want to have a great interview. And I'll do that before I really do anything, because I think that, see, we're connected with Spirit 24 hours a day. And all you have to do is ask. I mean, you'll read the book. I mean, I amaze people, because when I get in my car, I'll ask for a safe drive. I'll ask to get to my destination at the time that I want to get there. And then I ask for, when I get close, I ask for a parking place right away, close up. And I have amazed people in the height of the Christmas season, going to a mall and getting into the parking lot and ask Spirit. I don't do it necessarily out loud. I just ask them, you know, myself, you know, quietly. And will pull in, and just as we're pulling in, somebody's backing out. So, I'll say to them before that, I said, watch. I asked Spirit for a parking place right away. Watch when we get into the mall, when we get into the parking lot. Overpowering these fears, asking for what you want, works in all areas of your life.
Yeah. Well, listen, Michael, this has been a great interview. I've really enjoyed it and appreciated it. Now, you've got some things that you have put in place for people who want to talk more. What should they do? Where should they go?
Well, I have a lot of content on my website. And they can reach my website by just going, overpoweringfear.com. The book is available on Amazon. They don't have listed the ebook, but it will be there shortly. And when they get to my website, there's a spot for what I call an email subscription. And all they have to do is put in their name and their email addresses. What they'll get in return is an email back with a link, actually three links, to three audio MP3s. Now, these are, I've done these because I'm developing a set of CDs that will be about 12 to 14 CDs in the set that I'll retail on my website. But the first three CDs, they run from 45 minutes to an hour each, are free. So just go to overpoweringfear.com or michael-luckman.com, and you'll get to the same website, and it's right in the upper right-hand corner, and all they have to do is click on that, put in their name, their email address, and they'll get an email in return, and they can download those MP3 files.
Excellent. So they go to overpoweringfear.com and take a look at what's up there. And your book is available now on Amazon, right?
That's correct. It's Overpowering Fear.
Well, thank you, Michael, so much for being with us. This has been a joy. And I know you will do very well in this new path.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it, Will. And I've enjoyed this interview. You're a great interviewer. So anytime.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, the Pilgrim comes up with some wonderful people. Michael was a trainer in the Sandler Network for 10 years, and we got to know each other there, and he is now on a different path. Had some interesting things come up that, not anything he did, but some interesting things that came up because of totally out of his power that caused him to take a different direction, and he's having a wonderful time now. We had a nice chat before the interview, and he is thoroughly enjoying this new path, working with a wonderful editor in L.A. So the Pilgrim continues to look for new and interesting things out there, as Paul Roberts says, way out there beyond where other people are willing to go sometimes. So there we have it, another conversation with the Pilgrim on the 405. Look forward next week for what more we can bring to your attention. So look forward to talking with you again on Wednesday afternoon, Pilgrim on the 405. Make it a great week.